So it's a pleasure to be back here for a visit, and I thank the organizers for this conference and for asking me to give this talk. I'll be talking about two recent papers that are already in the archive with Clay Cordova, who just moved to Chicago, Dan Fried, who is a mathematician at Texas, my excellent student, who was a student here in PI, and me. Okay, so as a matter of introduction, it's standard to couple either a classical or quantum field theory to various sources, and it's always a good idea to think of the various coupling constants in the Lagrangian as background fields, because then we can explore what happens as we vary the coupling constants. And there are two complementary views on that, two complementary applications, and we'll see them again and again through this talk. One view is that we look at the coupling constant, and we view the theory as a function of the coupling constant, and as we vary the coupling constant, we have a one or multi-parameter family of theories, and we ask, how does the theory behave as we change the parameters? The second complementary view is that we make the coupling constant, they're fixed, I'm not going to vary them, but they vary in space or time, or space-time. And then we have what we can call defects or interfaces, and we've heard a lot about them here in the talk. One of the interesting points that I will emphasize in this talk is that it's good to think of the two applications together and view the theory as a functional of the background coupling constant. So I make the coupling constant background fields and view the theory as a functional of these coupling constants. So that's with the ordinary coupling constant. And this generalizes something else that has been done for a long time, and where we make not only the coupling constant space-time dependent, but we also couple the system to various background fields. So if we have a certain global symmetry, say U1, we couple the system to a background U1 gauge field. It's background or classical in the sense that it doesn't fluctuate. It's not a dynamical field. And we would like to explore the theory as a function or a functional of this background gauge field. Similarly, we would like to put the system in various geometries. And we do that not because we are interested in what QCD does on various complicated four manifolds, but this is just a trick or a tool to probe the theory. This is an observable of the theory, and we should study it. So we put the theory wherever we see a coupling constant de Lagrangian, we make it a classical field. Wherever we have a symmetry, we make it couple it to a background gauge field. We see geometry, there's energy momentum tensor, we couple the system to arbitrary metric, and we can put spin structure and so forth. And then we study the theory as a function of all these variables. Now, it's well known that if we consider only ordinary gauge symmetries, ordinary global symmetries, and space geometries, there could be an anomaly here. Namely, the theory is naively invariant on the gauge symmetries of the background fields, but in fact, the final answer is not gauge invariant under the background fields. So we will generalize this to all the coupling constants. And in a way, this is kind of a trivial statement. If the theory is not gauge invariant under the background gauge transformations of the background fields, it might also not be single valued as a function of the coupling constants if we make them space-time dependent. So an anomaly in the family of theories, why is it good? So one thing that is good about it is that we can use the same spirit of a Tuft and use these anomalies to constrain the long-distance behavior of the theory. This has been very useful, very productive over the last several decades using global symmetries. These are the celebrated Tuft anomaly matching. And now we can play the same game by considering anomalies in the space of coupling constants. And I will give examples of that later in the talk. And this has been quite useful in various tests of dualities. If you have two dual theories, they have the same global symmetry, they should have the same anomalies. And now we talk not only about symmetries, we also discuss the anomalies in coupling constants. They should also match between the two sides of the duality. And with the other application of space-time dependent coupling constants, we can make the coupling constant vary in space and or time. And then there would be defects. And then the anomaly, as we will see, will lead to consequences about the dynamics along the defect. So we have these two complementary things. One, the full theory has an anomaly in the space of coupling constants and global symmetries and geometry. And if we have a defect in the theory, the same anomaly is going to give us constraints on the dynamics along the interface. Now, many of the things I will say today are known, well known, and have been known for a long time, and many of you know them. So that might not look new to you. Say, oh, we already know that, so what's the big deal? The point is that this will be a unified view of many known phenomena, which will be unified in one framework. And they also, the unified view, I will not have time to do it in detail here. Since it's so unified and so streamlined, we have succeeded to find some mistakes in the existing literature showing the power of this method and to find new results. Now, in preparing this talk, I had a conflict because on one hand, I would really like to talk about the more advanced examples where the results are new and surprising and the method is shown to be powerful. But instead, I thought I would not do that, except perhaps toward the end of the talk, depending on how much time I have. And what I will do instead is study elementary examples, which are well understood. Everything about these examples is, these are solvable examples, so we can just write the exact solution with not a problem. But I will present that from the point of view of the modern point of view, from this point of view of the anomalies in coupling constants. And this way, it will be easier to understand what it is. And then in the remaining of the talk, I will discuss more subtle examples, depending on how much time I have. So as I said, this view will unify and streamline and will strengthen many known results and lead to new ones. We'll start by considering some example in quantum mechanics and two-dimensional gauge theories. I emphasize here again, these are elementary examples. So this formalism might look like overkill. Here is a solvable quantum mechanical system. Why do we need this more sophisticated formalism? But it will be good to have that so that when we come to more complicated things, we can always go back to the simple examples and realign it. So I'll then discuss more advanced examples, and I'll finish by comments on four-dimensional free fermions. This is again a solvable system, free, fully understood, and we'll show that it has an interesting anomaly that at least was not, at least in this way, it has not yet been presented. So let me turn to my favorite quantum mechanical system, one of my favorite ones. This is a particle on a ring. So this is the Lagrangian. This is a quadratic Lagrangian, so it's exactly solvable. Q is 2 pi periodic. It's identified with itself. There are instantons where Q winds around the Euclidean circle. And as a result, theta is identified with theta plus 2 pi. So theta is called the theta angle. And it's an angle because it's 2 pi periodic. And it's straightforward to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. This is the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. N is an integer. There are infinitely many levels, and their energies are given by this formula. And a key point here is that the 2 pi periodicity of theta is not manifest here, but instead, so if we just crank theta and bring it up by 2 pi, the spectrum goes back to itself, but the levels are rearranged. This will be the source of our anomaly. Our anomaly will be that, yes, we come back to the same spectrum, but the states are relabeled. So it's not quite the same statement. Now, when you have a system, the first thing to do is always to analyze the symmetries. This was emphasized at length yesterday. So what are the symmetries? There is one U1 symmetry that shifts Q by a constant. This is clearly a symmetry. There is also a symmetry we can call time reversal. It exists for any value of theta. Acts like this. And when theta is an integer multiple of pi, not 2 pi, there's also charge conjugation symmetry that maps Q to minus Q. When theta is 0, that's obvious. And when theta is pi, it's not so obvious, but since the integral of Q dot is always an integer, that is a symmetry of the system. So when theta is a multiple of pi, this U1 and this charge conjugation combine to the group O2. Now, a point that was emphasized in this paper is that when theta is an odd multiple of pi, like pi, 3 pi, etc., the Hilbert space is actually in a projective representation of O2. This is well known. And correspondingly, for theta equals pi, the state with n equals 0 and the state with n equals 1 are degenerate here. Now, normally in quantum mechanics, so what does the spectrum look like? They look like parabolas as a function of theta. And for theta equals pi, there's some level crossing. Normally in quantum mechanics, we don't have level crossing because levels try to repel each other as they try to cross each other. What happens here is that we do have level crossing, and it's perfectly natural because the two states at theta equals pi are related to each other by a symmetry. So the symmetry is enhanced. The two states are degenerate because of an underlying global symmetry, and therefore it's not surprising. So this fact that the Hilbert space is in a projective representation is important, and that also guarantees the level crossing at theta equals pi. In a more modern language, this was described in this paper as a mixed anomaly between this charge conjugation symmetry, this one, and this U1 symmetry. There's a mixed anomaly between them at theta equals pi, but it's not there at theta equals 0. Now, as I said before, whenever we have a global symmetry, we should couple it to a classical background field. In this case, it's a vector potential, A. So now the symmetry is gauge invariant. So uppercase is always classical, lowercase is dynamical. So lowercase is dynamical. And so this is the Lagrangian. So here we have Q dot plus A. Here we have Q dot plus A with theta. And we can also add a term that depends only on the classical background field. We call it the counter term. Normally, the word counter term is used for extra terms that we can add that respect all the symmetries. Here, this is an extra term that depends only on the classical field. So we'll call it the counter term. And it can be thought of as a Wilson line with charge K around the Euclidean circle. Therefore, this K has to be quantized for gauge invariance under A. So this Lagrangian is gauge invariant under A gauge transformation, under this U1 gauge transformations. And the space of coupling constants, which originally was only theta with 2 pi periodic, now it is theta, which is 2 pi periodic, and K, but the periodicity is a little bit more subtle, because as you can check here, when you shift theta by 2 pi, you really need to subtract 1 from K in order to keep the Lagrangian invariant. So the parameter space is not a circle for theta that appears an infinite number of times labeled by k, but instead the parameter space is more like a helix. So as we move theta by 2 pi, we have to shift k by 1. And this is related to the fact that the spectrum, each state is not invariant as the theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, but the full spectrum is. So as we shift theta by 2 pi, all the states are shifted, and this is related to this enhance this mixing of the in the identification. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say about this system, but now let's start modifying it and make it less solvable. So we, for example, can break the U1 symmetry to Zn, for example, by adding a potential. So we add a potential, say, cosine nq. Now we no longer have the U1 symmetry, we have only Zn. And as we have that, we can repeat the analysis we did before. Now the system is, in general, for general potential, is not exactly solvable, but maybe we can do it numerically, but in general, it's not solvable. But some of the qualitative conclusions do not change. For n even, there is still a mixed anomaly between charge conjugation and that Zn, if theta equals pi, there is an anomaly. And hence, the ground state is degenerate there. That's still true. For n odd, there is no such mixed anomaly. More mathematically, we can say that we can add a counter term to restore all the symmetries, so we add this counter term. The problem is with the add this counter term is it removes the problem at theta equals pi, but puts the problem at theta equals 0. So here we get something which is slightly more subtle. It's not an anomaly. An anomaly is a statement that there is a conflict between, we sit at one value in the parameters, and we have a conflict between different symmetries. Here, we don't have that at theta equals pi. We can remove the conflict at theta equals pi, but only at the expense of introducing a conflict at theta equals 0. So strictly speaking, this is not an anomaly. There's no conflict between anything if you just sit at one theta. The problem is more global. If you want a system not to have an anomaly at theta equals 0, and you want to keep the same values of the counter terms, then you necessarily have a problem at theta equals pi, but it's not an anomaly. This is the beginning of what I'm going to talk about soon, that It's not an anomaly in the sense of symmetries do not work, because there's no anomaly here, but there's kind of an inconsistency. People use the word global, the phrase global inconsistency. You cannot choose counter terms that will preserve the symmetry without an anomaly, both at theta equals zero and at theta equals pi. And we'll soon phrase that a little bit differently. But now let's make the system even more complicated. We can put an arbitrary potential that preserves Zn, and we can also break the time reversal symmetry or the charge conjugation. So we can add more terms, for example, more degrees of freedom and more interactions, ending up with something like this, such that we have only Zn. So we don't have the U1 and we don't have charge conjugation, and therefore we can no longer discuss anomalies between charge conjugation and Zn simply because the charge conjugation is not a symmetry. So I break explicitly all the symmetries, and all I have is Zn. And now I can still turn on a background gauge field A for the Zn global symmetry. So it's a gauge field. And we can add this counter term. Now K is an integer mod n. And again, we have the same helix that we had before, except that it's n periodic. So because the symmetry is Zn, if I shift K by n, I come back to the same point. So I still have this, it's more like a slinky. You know, it goes around, but then it's connected to the beginning and then goes again. So what we see is that as we shift theta by 2 pi, the states are rearranged, the same thing that happened before. And as a result, I claim there should be level crossing somewhere. So every state carries some Zn charge, because that's a global symmetry of the system. And as I move theta by 2 pi, the Zn charge is shifted by 1. The spectrum at theta equals 0 and say in 2 pi must look the same as a set, but all the states will have to move by 1 because the charge of the ground state changes. And therefore, there should be many level crossings in between, and in particular, the ground state crosses. Now, we don't have charge conjugation symmetry that would tell us that the crossing is necessarily at theta equals pi. The crossing could be at other points, but we do know that there must be level crossing. This is the quantum mechanical version of a phase transition. We look at the low energy theory, there's only one state. We track that state as we crank theta up. And at some point, another state comes down, they are degenerate, and then the ground state is the other one, the other state. So why did this happen? I said before that normally you don't have level crossing in quantum mechanics. And I said that the example where we did have level crossing before was that we had an enhanced symmetry at that particular point, which made the ground state degenerate because it was in the representation of a larger symmetry group. How did it happen here? The two levels that cross carry different charges under some global symmetry, in this case, Zn. They carry different charges, and therefore there is no mixing between them. So the standard level repulsion does not happen. So this is a bit surprising, because what this means is that many of the phenomena that I discussed earlier as associated with the symmetry in the global symmetry, so is an anomaly in the global symmetry, are still present. There is level crossing at some point, the states are rearranged, but the source of the problem is not an anomaly, but something else. Because there's no anomaly here, because the symmetry is only Zn, there's no anomaly in the Zn symmetry. So I would like to argue that we should think of it as a mixed anomaly between the Zn global symmetry and the identification of theta. This is the source of the problem. It's not a problem, it's a feature. We want to identify theta in theta plus 2 pi, but that is not compatible with the Zn symmetry. We cannot have both of them simultaneously, and it feels a lot like an anomaly, and I will soon phrase it like an anomaly. So we therefore have two views on the parameter space. One, we say, no, the periodicity of theta is not 2 pi, but instead it is 2 pi n, and then we have no problem with Zn. Or we could insist on the 2 pi periodicity of theta, but that would violate the Zn symmetry. So we can think of it as a generalized anomaly between the Zn symmetry and the theta identification. And an anomaly is often described as an anomaly theory, which is a classical theory in the background fields in one dimension higher, and that's it. So in one dimension higher, this is quantum mechanics, it's one dimensional, so here we have to go to two dimensions. So the anomaly action, which is normally a gauge invariant expression in one dimension higher, so in here in two dimensions, we can write this expression. So So this expression captures the anomaly of the, this expression captures the anomaly, the mixed anomaly between the Zn, which is this carried by this gauge field A, and the 2 pi periodicity of theta, which is represented by this term. So this is the term that represents the anomaly, and all the results we discussed earlier can be derived from this expression. So we have this anomaly, and we are going to have two kinds of applications, the same kind of applications I mentioned earlier in the talk. First, we can view the system as a one-parameter family of theories labeled by theta. We are still doing just quantum mechanics, so this is something you could, in principle, teach in your undergraduate quantum mechanics course, or maybe in your graduate quantum mechanics course, but you don't need any field theory for all these phenomena. And you don't have any fermions that are subtle and so forth. This is a purely bosonic system in quantum mechanics. So we view the system as a one-parameter family of theories labeled by theta, and what the anomaly tells us is that there must be a level crossing somewhere. There must be a phase transition somewhere. The second application is we can think of interfaces or defects as theta varies. Here I put the interface in quotations because it is an interface in Euclidean time rather than in space. In the later examples, we'll have interfaces in space. So theta varies as a function of, theta is going to vary as a function of Euclidean time. As I will soon show, this interface necessarily carries Zn charge. And that's the origin of the anomaly. So the interface carries Zn charge. One way of thinking about it is if we think of it as a one-parameter family of theories, we consider this theta as being a number, we pull it out, and that represents the anomaly. And the alternative, theta varies in Euclidean time, so we integrate by parts. The integral of d theta is we integrate that over the Euclidean time, we get a number, and that tells us that that configuration carries charge. I will make it more explicit now. So we would like to think of theta as being Euclidean time, as a function of Euclidean time. So we need to define what we mean by theta q dot, the integral of theta q dot, more carefully. So q dot has no problem. Q dot is circle valued. So q is circle valued, so q dot is periodic. And therefore, this part is well defined. But this theta is not well defined because as theta varies, if it winds around the Euclidean circle, it's not a function in R. And when we integrate here, what should we put? Should we put theta or should we put theta plus 2 pi? And we are going to get different answers. So this thing has been understood in mathematics. It comes under the name of differential cohomology. But in this case, we can actually give a very lowbrow presentation of what needs to be done. So the goal of this slide is to define this integral of theta q dot when both theta and q are Euclidean time dependent, and both of them vary as a function of theta. So what do we mean by this integral? So we divide the Euclidean circle into patches. In each patch, theta is a function into R, and there we can easily integrate, so that we do in each patch. But when there are transition functions, when theta jumps by a multiple of 2 pi, we have to put such a correction factor. And this thing is well defined because in every patch, this is meaningful. This is meaningful on the where we jump on the transitions. And you can check that this expression with the correction factor does all the things we want. It's independent of the trivialization. This is a little exercise in, well, you just change it where you jump and you keep track of this. So you get a contribution from one patch and another contribution from the other one. And this contributes, and all of them together contribute in a sensible way. It's both invariant under the 2 pi periodicity of q and theta. It's not manifest, but the mistake from one is canceled against the other. And we also see that when theta has total winding number, so if theta doesn't have any winding number, we don't need to use patches. And therefore, we cover the whole thing with one patch, and then we don't need this correction term, and there's nothing subtle. But if theta winds, namely, we have some interface along the circle, then this is not invariant under the U1 symmetry. Because altogether, this thing carries charge n for every winding of theta. So that is a very explicit way to see that if we have an interface and theta varies in time, then we violate the U1 symmetry. As long as theta does not wind, we don't violate the U1 symmetry, but if theta does violate, the partition function, or this term in the action, is not invariant under the U1 symmetry, and that's our anomaly. So to avoid confusion, I would like to distinguish between three kinds of interfaces. And it's really surprising how much confusion there is about these definitions in the literature. So first, we can imagine theta varies from 0 to 2 pi m in a smooth fashion. Since it changes in a smooth fashion, the answer is universal. The quantum mechanical problem should give us a unique answer. There is no ambiguity here. And many of the defects that are discussed in this workshop are of this kind. Then there's another kind of defect, which is also discussed in this workshop, but should be distinguished from it. And this is when theta varies by a jump. So it's 2 pi m here and 0 here. But in between, there is a sharp jump. And if there is a sharp jump, this is also an interface or a defect. But since there is a sharp jump, the answer is not universal, and you have to provide more information. For example, you can stick a local operator at this point for the defect. And we heard talked about that yesterday. And I really emphasize that the talk we had yesterday is about this kind of interface and not about this kind, which is smooth. So here there's no place. Well, you can stick an operator, but this is not a property of the defect. Here you can hide another local operator at the point of the defect. And the third is what I've been talking about so far. It's a special kind of this one, where theta is 2 pi m here and 0 here. And the particular operator that I stick in here is e to the I m q, with m here is the same as the m of the jump. And this interface is completely transparent. So theta jumps. That's something dramatic. There is a local operator inserted at that point. But as you cross this point, nothing really happens. So if we tune this operator appropriately, this interface can be thought of as a transparent interface. There's nothing going on here. And we'll see high-dimensional generalizations of that later in the talk. So let's go back to the smooth interface, but let's make it steep. So it's smooth, and therefore it's universal. There's a unique answer. There's no room to stick any operator there, because if you look every place, theta varies in a continuous fashion. But if it's rapid enough, we can use what is known in quantum mechanics as the sudden approximation. So we evolve, again, this is Euclidean times. We evolve here with theta equals 0. And then over a short time, theta jumped by 2 pi m, and we know that this relabels the states. Every state n is mapped to the state n plus m. So this is the change. And then we continue with the evolution here. So this is as if we put the operator, so instead of having such a steep but smooth interface, it is as if we put the operator e to the I m q at the point of the jump. So instead of saying that theta varies, we can say theta didn't vary, but we insert this operator e to the I m q, it does exactly the same thing. So again, we see that if theta winds m times around the Euclidean circle, the U1 symmetry is violated by m units. How much time do I have? This clock showed me the real time. It's not the time of the talk, and I did not reset mine. 20 minutes, perfect. So far, I emphasized that what we have here is not an anomaly in the symmetry. There's a mixed anomaly between the periodicity of theta and a symmetry. I'd like to make a side remark about how to think about it also as a symmetry, which is specific to this example, but I think is illuminating. So normally an anomaly is associated with a global symmetry, a zero form, one form symmetry, etc. But we can think of the anomaly I've just described as associated with a minus one form symmetry. Now I put it in quotations because there's no such thing as a minus one form symmetry. There's a zero form symmetry, but there's no minus one form symmetry. It doesn't act on anything. And it's related to the fact that there are zero brains, one brain, two brains, etc., but there are no minus one brains. So there are the things that are called minus one brains. These are instantons, but they are not brains in the sense that they are not objects. This is an instance. This is a configuration in the path integral. It's an instanton, but they do not transform into other minus one brains. They carry some charge, but they carry minus one brain charge. So it's not really a symmetry. But if we put this pedantic thing aside, we can think of what we have here as a minus one form symmetry. And then we can think of theta as being a gauge field. Notice that it carries no indices. It's a scalar. So it's kind of minus one. If A mu is for a zero form symmetry, theta with no index is a minus one form symmetry. And it can have transition functions where it jumps by 2 pi times an integer. And then d theta can be thought of as the field strength because it's well-defined even over overlaps. And then the anomaly we discussed follows the standard picture of anomalies, except that here we have an anomaly in a minus one form symmetry. Depending on time, I'll show examples where this is not the case, and this interpretation as a minus one form symmetry does not hold. So I think we had enough of quantum mechanics, and let's graduate a little bit, not a lot. Question? Yes.
You have this time-dependent Hamiltonian, right? And suddenly you change the Hamiltonian, and it's not adiabatically. Why doesn't a state mix with a complicated combination of many states? Aren't you pumping lots of energy suddenly?
Okay, so what is the sudden approximation?
Yeah, what's the sudden approximation?
What is your favorite quantum mechanics book? Whatever it is.
I learned about adiabatic. Sudden.
It's not adiabatic. So there are two limits. There's the adiabatic, where you track the states. Uh-huh. And then there's the sudden approximation, which appears in the standard quantum mechanics books. And then what you do is you evolve up to here with the standard Hamiltonian. And then you assume that this is sudden. So the state, you have to relabel the states and continue with the new Hamiltonian. This is called the sudden approximation. I learned about it many, many years ago. But I still remember that.
But if you don't do it exactly sudden, but at the limit of one becoming steeper and steeper.
This becomes more and more accurate.
Yeah.
This has become more and more. Just Google sudden approximation. Sorry?
It's the same as a quench.
What did you call?
Quench.
Quench. I did not. When I went to school, that word was not. This happened when the dinosaurs roamed the earth and so forth. But if you don't like the term, it's still true. You evolve with the state, and then you continue with the new Hamiltonian. And here I did the similarity transformation to say, no, you keep the Hamiltonian as it was, but you relabel the states. And this is a free system, so you just do it. And then when you add the interactions that I added, the more complicated ones, it goes the same way, except that you can't analyze it exactly. So let's move to 1 plus 1 dimension, and I'll start being a little bit briefer. I would like to show an example of a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. It comes under various names. So we start with a U1 gauge theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions, in 2 dimensions, with n scalar fields, phi I, with charge 1 under the U1 symmetry, and a potential, which is an arbitrary function that perhaps to be a function of phi absolute value squared to be U1 gauge invariant, and we also impose an SUN symmetry that rotates the n different scalar fields. So, and we also include the theta parameter, which is this term. Now, this system has been beaten to death over the last several decades, and there's a lot of physics in this system, and the system has many phases, and the phases have been analyzed, and it has applications in condensed matter system. This thing is really a huge subject, but I'm going to touch only on one aspect of it. And in particular, we're not going to assume charge conjugation symmetry, which is crucial in most of the discussion in the literature. And so what's the global symmetry? So the global symmetry is not really SUN, but it is PSUN, only projective representations, because if we try to make a gauge invariant operator made out of phi, there must be equal numbers of phis and phi bars, and therefore all the gauge invariant operators transform trivially under the center of SUN. So the global symmetry is PSUN, not SUN. And that means that when we couple the system to a background gauge field for the global symmetry, we should also allow background PSUN gauge fields, which are not background SUN gauge fields. And they are labeled by a characteristic class that physicists call Stifel-Whitney, but mathematicians would call it beta Bauer class. In any event, this is a second cohomology with Zn coefficients with of the background fields, which is non-trivial. It's an integer modulo n, which tells us which PSUN bundle we put the system in. So it's a characteristic class that measures the obstruction to lifting PSUN bundle to SUN, and to SUN bundles, and in this K is the coefficient N modulo, it is an integer modulo N, and this is our counter term, which plays a role analogous to the term K times A in the previous example. So this PSUN is analogous to the U1 or ZN we had in the previous example. And this B plays the role of A in the previous example. And this W2 of B plays the role of the integral of A in the previous example. So as in the previous example, theta is no longer 2 pi periodic. But when we shift theta by 2 pi, we have to shift K, that appears here, by 1. And therefore, we are going to have a lot of the stuff that we had before. Now, in earlier discussions of this paper, of this topic, including in particular this paper, the focus was on charge conjugation symmetry that exists at theta equals pi, and various things that happen necessarily at theta equals pi. And again, there's an anomaly between charge conjugation and PSUN at theta equals pi, and that depends on whether n is even or n is odd, very much like in the previous example. But the point I'm going to emphasize today is that it should better be thought of as a mixed anomaly between this PSUN and the theta periodicity, very much like in the previous example. So I just copied this formula. And this mixed identification can be thought of as a mixed anomaly between the theta identification and the PSUN bundle. And therefore, it should be describable by a term in three dimensions, because this original system was in two, the anomaly is in three. And this is the term. So the anomaly is this three-dimensional term, integral d theta, W2 of b. This is a nice term in three dimensions, which captures the anomaly. And again, I emphasize, I do not need to have charge conjugation. You can violate charge conjugation, make the system much more complicated. The transition will no longer happen at pi. It could happen elsewhere, but there will necessarily have to be a transition. Now, what do we do when we have an anomaly? We do the same thing we did before. There are two complementary applications. One, a one-parameter family of theories, and the other is interfaces. So as a one-parameter family, we say the system is gapped, and therefore the low-energy theory as a function of theta must have the same anomaly that appears at high energy. So at high energy, we found this anomaly. At low energies, there must be the same anomaly. There must be the same mixed anomaly between theta periodicity and PSUN. So a low-energy observer who sits there and sees a gap phase with nothing interesting must account for this anomaly. And therefore, as we crank theta from 0 to 2 pi, there will necessarily have to be a phase transition if the system is gapped. So this way, it's very much in the spirit of a Tuft. There must be something at low energies that accounts for that anomaly. And what this typically is a certain first-order phase transition. And notice that we do not assume charge conjugation, and therefore we don't know where the transition is, but we do know that there must be an anomaly. There must be a transition. The second application is interfaces. Now this is a genuine interface in space. Imagine space is a circle. This is 1 + 1 dimension. So space is a circle. And imagine theta winds around space. Still, we need to define it a little bit more carefully, as I did before with patches and so forth. But the upshot is very simple. If theta winds around by m units around the circle, we have an effective quantum mechanical system, because imagine we look from very long distances, we don't care that there is a circle there. And the long distance physics, the Hilbert space will not be in a representation of SUN, of PSUN, it will be in a projective representation of PSUN. It's in a representation with nullity m. Now, there's a very simple physical picture that explains what's going on here. When we crank theta up by 2 pi, regarding of what the potential is, theta can be thought of as a background field. This was understood by Sidney Coleman. Theta is a background field. And as we crank theta by 2 pi, we can pair create phi quanta out of the vacuum and send them to screen the electric field. But as we do that, they violate the SUN symmetry. They carry a nullity of SUN. So if theta is shifted by 2 pi times m, the annulity of SUn is violated by m units, and therefore the interface, if we have such an interface, carries annulity m, and the interface is in a projective representation of PSUn, it's a representation with annulity m. So it all fits together, and the and the elegant way to say it is this. So if we vary theta, so we think of theta as varying in the third direction, we see that we get different SPT phases at theta equals 0 and theta equals 2 pi that comes from the last term. Alternatively, if theta varies in space, we integrate over space on this term, and then this thing tells us there is an anomaly in SUn in the effective quantum mechanical system. So it's the same simple mathematical expression, this one, that captures the two different physics, the physics of a first-order phase transition as we vary theta, and the physics of the interface. I really cannot resist running quickly through an example in four dimensions so that it will not look as if all I was doing playing games in one and two dimensions. So the system I would like to discuss is a four-dimensional SUn theory. I'll do it very briefly. It has a one-form global symmetry, Zn. And what that means is that we can turn on a two-form gauge field, B. And a non-zero two-form B says that the underlying bundles that we sum over are not SUn bundles, but instead they are PSUn bundles. In a PSUn bundle theory, we have to sum over all these twists. In an SUn theory, this is an observable in the theory. The observable depends on some two-form gauge field B, which is a Zn gauge field, and it constrains W2, this cohomology, of the dynamical gauge field. So these are the Atuft twisted configurations. And again, we can go through all the words I said before and say, I'm not going to assume charge conjugation, I'm not going to assume time reversal, I had enough interactions to violate all of these. But there is still an anomaly, a mixed anomaly, between shifting theta by 2 pi and this Zn one-form symmetry. And this is the anomaly. The anomaly is described by a five-dimensional term because this is a four-dimensional gauge theory. So the anomaly is described by a five-dimensional term. And this is it. This is the term. And this term can be used. So this is the Pontryagin square of B. If you don't follow the details, it doesn't matter. The important thing is that there is a global symmetry and theta periodicity. There is a mixed anomaly between them. And we can use this anomaly either to study interfaces or to study the theory as a function of theta and study some dynamics. Now, this is a very beautiful formula because it's relatively simple. And very simple applications of it were discussed even in this conference yesterday. But there are many, many applications of this which had already been discovered earlier, but they all appear as trivial consequences of this one simple formula. So the first example is n equals 1 super Young Mills. We heard about it yesterday. And here there is a mixed anomaly between the Z2nr symmetry and the Zn one-form symmetry. This anomaly was discussed first in this paper. And that leads to into that constraints on domain walls, and this, that's in agreement with the string construction of Achara and Vafa. So historically, Achara and Vafa found a TQFT on the domain wall. This was explained as a consequence of a mixed anomaly between the Z2R symmetry and the Zn one-form symmetry in this paper. And then I say that it actually follows from this expression, even if we don't have the Z2nr symmetry. So the Z2nr symmetry has nothing to do with it. All we have is theta goes, as we go from one vacuum to another, theta jumps by 2 pi. And therefore, any domain wall where theta jumps by 2 pi, and we heard about it yesterday. So it's theta jumps by 2 pi. Even if there's no R symmetry, we added more interactions that break the R symmetry and so forth. This anomaly tells us that there must be a TQFT on the wall which saturates that anomaly. So this is one application. The second application is a phase transition at theta equals pi, which was explained as a consequence of a mixed anomaly between time reversal and the one-form symmetry in this paper. So in this paper, we argue that there is such an anomaly, and therefore there must be a phase transition. Now I say, forget time reversal. We don't even need time reversal. It again follows from this equation, where now a theta doesn't vary in space, as in a domain world, but instead I have a one-parameter family of theories, and there must be something in the low-energy theory to account for the anomaly. And as I said, we can use the anomaly in similar systems without time reversal. And we can actually extend that further and study various different interfaces as theta varies by a multiple of 2 pi. And they were discussed recently in these papers. And now we say that many of the results in these papers, again, follow trivially from one universal formula. So it's one universal formula, which is very simple, that gives us all these different distinct applications. And again, we have the three kinds of interfaces: the smooth interface, which is universal; the discontinuous one, which is not universal, because it's discontinuous, and then we can stick an operator there, telling us that indeed it is not universal. And then there's the special one, which is transparent, where theta jumps by 2 pi m, and we put a specific operator here. In that case, it was a Chern-Simons term that figures in the talk yesterday on this domain wall. So we either met theta jump or we put the Chern-Simons term. If we do both, then it's completely transparent. Finally, I would like to go to the last example, which is free but has many new elements. And this is a free massive Weyl fermion in 4 dimensions. And again, this has been beaten to death. There's huge literature on this subject. And the parameter is the complex mass. So we have one Weyl fermion, Pirano fermion. I better think of it as Weyl. It is a complex mass. It's a two-dimensional representation of the Lorentz group. And we could put a complex mass. So when the mass is non-zero, there is no symmetry in the problem. But if the mass is very big, we can intuitively think of the fermion as not being there. And therefore, effectively, we can compactify the M-plane, and then we can think of it as having a two-cycle in the parameter space. It doesn't matter. An important thing is that M, we're thinking about the whole complex plane. Now, what are the parameters? Naively, we can remove the phase of M by performing a chiral rotation on the fermions. We can rotate the fermion by e to the I alpha, but because of the gravitational anomaly, the Lagrangian is shifted by an R-wedge R term. So now, by now, we know what we need to do. We have an R-wedge R. If there's curvature, we activate this R-wedge R term. And therefore, we must add a counter term to the Lagrangian. This is like the Ka term in the quantum mechanics example and similar terms in 2 and 4 dimensions. And now the cast of characters is a complex M parameter and a gravitational theta parameter. But instead of saying that the theory is labeled by a complex M, or we remove the phase and make M real, and a gravitational theta angle G, a theta G, which is 2 pi periodic, instead we have this identification. So the parameter space is really a complex M and a phase, 2 pi periodic phase, theta gravitational, with some identifications between them. This is what this shift in the anomaly means. So now we have the cast of characters, and we know the anomaly. So we have these parameters, and we have this anomaly. And for non-zero M, we say, oh, there's an anomaly. We can remove the phase, think of M as being real, and put it all in the counter term. So therefore, we could say, aha, we can describe the parameter space only with the real mass M and some theta parameter. But that cannot be done globally. We can do that if we remove one point, say the or m equals zero. So around, away from m equals zero, we can remove the phase of the mass and have just say the mass is real, who cares about it? We can add a counter term to fix it. But we cannot do that at m equals zero. And we cannot do it for all complex m. And again, this can be described as an anomaly. We have a mixed anomaly between gravity and the value of m. And since this is a four-dimensional problem, we write such a five-dimensional term. It's an integral d to m, because m is a complex number. We integrate it over the complex m-plane, put a delta function at m equals zero. We could put here any two form which integrates to one on the complex plane, and a gravitational theta, the gravitational Chern-Simons term in four dimensions, or since this is the anomaly is Z, we can write a six-dimensional expression, which is again a two-form in M times R wedge R. And how do we use this anomaly? By now I sound like a broken record. Two kinds of applications. This is vinyl records. They don't really have broken records. There are two kinds of applications. One is a two-parameter family of theories. So we know that at some point in the complex M-plane, there must be something else. The theory cannot remain trivially gapped with this mass term, when the mass is non-zero. And with the case of the free fermion, it's really easy because we know that at M equals zero, the fermion is massless, so it's clearly non-trivial there. But now we can take this system and add more scalar fields and more interactions and break all the symmetries, and doesn't matter. And yet, the anomaly tells us that somewhere in the complex M-plane, something will have to give. If we don't have any symmetry, it will not necessarily be at M equals zero, but somewhere in the complex M-plane, the theory should be different, cannot be trivially gapped. So this is one kind of application. And the second is to ask, consider defects. So for example, let M be x plus iy. So M rotates around the xy, on the xy plane. And this can be thought of as a string along the z-axis. Exactly this string was analyzed many decades ago by Jacquive and Rossi. And now we say, this term is integrated over the xy plane, and therefore we have an effective 1 plus 1 dimensional theory along the string, which must have an anomaly, which is simply read off from here. As a result, this exactly the same expression tells us that there must be a chiral theory along the defect, and in this case it has C left minus C right equals a half. In the case of the free fermion, we can actually solve it. It's a massless fermion along the string, which follows from some index theorem. Now we see that it follows from here, from this anomaly. But more generally, now we can add scalar fields and make it more complicated. The anomaly is robust, and it's still true that we have these massless fermions. So in conclusion, because he's getting angry with me, to study ordinary anomalies, we couple every global symmetry to a classical background field and place the theory in arbitrary space-time. This is completely standard, and I don't have to emphasize it to this audience. Some people here know that better, much better than I do. And we denote all background fields by big A. And the anomaly is the statement that the partition function might not be gauge invariant or coordinate invariant as we vary this A by a gauge transformation. And we describe it by a higher dimensional classical theory, classical field theory for A. This is completely standard, and there are a billion papers about it. Now, what we say here is that just as we do that with the background gauge fields and the metric, we should do the same thing with all the coupling constants, say lambda, make them also space-time dependent and view the theory as a function of these space-time dependent fields. And again, there might be an anomaly, and the anomaly is described by a higher dimensional classical field theory for A and lambda. And as with ordinary anomalies, it's invariant under renormalization group flow, and hence the power in using it. And therefore, we can use it to constrain the long-distance dynamics, and we can learn that there must be some at low energies, there must be some phase transitions as we vary the parameters. We can also study defects by using the same anomaly, and I gave various examples of that. Now, we presented examples of this and the consequences in several different, we presented several different examples. We showed one example in quantum mechanics, one example in two dimensions, SUN gauge theory and a four-dimensional massless fermion, massive fermion. And the parameter space was either one, can be thought of either as a one cycle or two cycles. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. We have studied many more examples. We studied SUN, spin-n, SPN, with quarks, without quarks, how it mixes with the flavor symmetry. There's a very rich structure there. And it sounds kind of becomes like a machine, you know, that say, okay, what's the symmetry? What's the anomaly? What are the parameters? We write the anomaly. What are the consequences? there must be a phase transition, there are defects. So it's always the same story, which is very reassuring every time it works. But I do want to emphasize that we have done very little of what can be done. There's a lot more that can be done, and we haven't done it. Thank you.
Done. So what happens in three dimensions? I know that there are no ordinary anomalies, but you might have
in three dimensions.
Can you define this kind of generalized anomaly?
Yeah, so first of all, there are anomalies in three dimensions. There's this famous parity anomaly in three dimensions, which is a mixed anomaly between time reversal and, say, U1. Or they're cousins of it, which are related. And you can actually recast it in this language. So imagine you consider one fermion in three dimensions. So there's a mass, which can be thought of as being real, to have some symmetry. So you have a real mass. And then there's a mixed anomaly between the mass and, say, gravity, very similar to what we had in four dimensions. In four dimensions, it was d2m times gravity, and here it's 1m because it's one-dimensional. So yeah, so there are. So first of all, yes, there are examples. They are not continuous anomalies like the triangle anomaly, but there are anomalies with symmetries, and there are anomalies similar to the one I mentioned with as a function of the mass. And for all I know, there are many others. So the one with the real mass we analyzed in the paper in a lot of detail. In the papers, I should say. We wrote two papers. One of them is kind of more introductory, working out the simple examples, and the second was more advanced about the four-dimensional gauge theory. So that was in the first paper.
Both not, but thank you again.